But all the time we were laughing, we were scared half out of our minds, maybe more than half. And all the time we were laughing, I was sick over Arnie, both over what he had seen and what I had done. And I think Lee felt the same. It's just that sometimes you have to laugh. Sometimes you just do, and when it comes, nothing can keep that laugh away. It just walks in and does its stuff. "So, what do I tell my folks?" she asked me, when we finally started to come down a little. "I've got to tell them something, Dennis. I can't just let them risk being run down in the street." "Nothing," I said. "Tell them nothing at all. But, for one thing, they wouldn't believe you. For another, nothing's going to happen as long as Arnie's in Libertyville. I'd stake my life on that." "You are, dummy," she whispered. "I know. My life, my mother's, my father's, my sister's."
"How will we know if he leaves?"
"I'll take care of that. You're going to be sick tomorrow. You're not going to school."
"I'm sick right now," she said in a low voice. "Dennis, what's going to happen? What are you planning?"
"I'll call you later tonight," I said, and kissed her. Her lips were cold. When I got home, Elaine was struggling into her parka and muttering black imprecations at people who sent other people down to Tom's for milk and bread just when Dance Fever was coming on TV. She was prepared to be grumpy at me as well, but she cheered up when I offered to give her a lift down to the market and back. She also gave me a suspicious look, as if this unexpected kindness to the little sister might be the onset of some disease, herpes maybe. She asked me if I felt all right. I only smiled blandly and told her to hop in before I changed my mind, although by now my right leg was aching and my left was throbbing fiercely. I could talk on and on to Lee about how Christine wouldn't roll as long as Arnie was in Libertyville, and intellectually I knew that was right. But it didn't change the instinctive rolling in my guts when I thought of Ellie walking the two blocks to Tom's and crossing the dark suburban side streets in her bright yellow parka. I kept seeing Christine parked down one of those streets, crouched in the dark like an old bitch hunting dog. When we got to Tom's, I gave her a buck. "Get us each a yodel and a Coke," I said.
"Dennis, are you feeling all right?"
"Yes, and if you put my change in that Asteroids game, I'll break your arm." That seemed to set her mind at rest. She went in, and I sat slumped behind the wheel of my duster, thinking about what a terrible box we were in. We couldn't talk to anyone. That was the nightmare. That was where Christine was so strong. Was I going to grab my dad down in his toy shop and tell him that what Ellie called Arnie Cunningham's pukey old red car was now driving itself? Was I going to call the cops and tell them that a dead guy wanted to kill my girlfriend and myself? No. The only thing on our side, other than the fact that the car couldn't move until Arnie had an alibi, was the fact that it would want no witnesses. Moochie Welch, Don Vandenberg, and Will Darnell had been killed alone, late at night. Buddy Repperton and his two friends had been killed out in the boonies. Elaine came back with a bag clutched to her budding bosom, got in, gave me my Coke and my yodel. "Change?" I said. "You're a booger snot," she said, and put some 20-odd cents in my outstretched hand. "I know, but I love you anyway," I said. I pushed her hood back, ruffled her hair, and then kissed her ear. She looked surprised and suspicious, and then she smiled. She wasn't such a bad sort, my sister Ellie. The thought of her being run down in the street simply because I fell in love with Lee Cabot after Arnie went mad and left her, I simply wasn't going to let that happen. At home, I worked my way upstairs after saying hi to my mom. She wanted to know how the leg was doing, and I told her it was in good shape. But when I got upstairs, I made the bathroom medicine cabinet my first stop. I swallowed a couple of aspirin for the sake of my legs, which were now singing Ave Maria. Then I went down to my folks' bedroom, where the upstairs phone is, and sat down in Mom's rocking chair with a sigh. I picked up the phone and made the first of my calls. "Dennis Gilder, scourge of the Turnpike Extension Project," Brad Jeffries said heartily. "Good to hear from you, kiddo. When are you going to come over and watch the Penguins with me again?" "I don't know," I said. "I get tired of watching handicapped people play hockey after a while. Now, if you got interested in a good team like the Flyers..." "Christ, I have to listen to this from a kid that didn't even mind?" Brad asked. "The world really is going to hell, I guess." We chatted for a while longer, just kicking things back and forth, and then I told him why I had called. He laughed.
What the fuck, Danny? You going into business for yourself?
You might say so, I thought of Christine, for a limited time only.
Don't want to talk about it?
Well, not just yet. Do you know someone who might have an item like that for me?
I'll tell you, Dennis, there's only one guy I know who might do business with you on anything like that. Johnny Pomberton lives out on the Ridge Road. He's got more rolling stock than Carter's got liver pills.
Okay, I said. Thanks, Brad.
How's Arnie?
All right, I guess. I don't see as much of him as I used to.
Funny guy, Dennis. I never in my wildest dreams thought he'd last out the summer the first time I set eyes on him. But he had one hell of a lot of determination.
Yeah, I said. All of that and then some.
Say hi to him when you see him.
I'll do it, Brad. Stay loose.
Can't live if you do anything else, Denny. Come on over some night and peel a few cans with me.
I will. Good night.
Night.
I hung up and then hesitated over the phone for a minute or two, not really wanting to make this next call, but it had to be done. It was central to the whole sorry, stupid business. I picked the telephone up and dialed the Cunningham's number from memory. If Arnie answered, I would simply hang up without speaking. But my luck was in. It was Michael who answered.
Hello?
His voice sounded tired and a bit slurred.
Michael, this is Dennis.
Hey, hi. He sounded genuinely pleased.
Is Arnie there?
Upstairs. He came home from somewhere and went right to his room. He looked pretty thundery, but that's far from unusual these days. Want me to call him?
No, I said. That's okay. It was really you I wanted to talk to anyhow. I need a favor.
Sure, name it. I realized what the slur in his voice was. Michael Cunningham was at least halfway snookered.
You did us a hell of a favor, talking some sense to him about college.
Michael, I don't think he listened to a thing I said.
Well, something sure happened. He's applied to 3 schools just this month. Regina thinks you walk on water, Dennis. And just between me and thee, she's pretty ashamed of the way she treated you when Arnie first told us about his car. But you know Regina. She's never been able to say I'm sorry.
I knew that, all right. And what would Regina think, I wondered, if she knew that Arnie, or whatever controlled Arnie, didn't have any more interest in college than a hog has in mutual funds, that he was simply following Lee's tracks, hounding her, fixated on her. It was perversion on perversion, LeBay, Lee, and Christine in some hideous menage a trois.
Listen, Michael, I said. I'd like you to call me if Arnie decides to go out of town for some reason, especially in the next day or two, or over the weekend, day or night. I have to know if Arnie's going to leave Libertyville, and I have to know before he leaves. It's very important.
Why?
I'd just as soon not go into that. It's complicated, and it would... Well, it would sound crazy.
There was a long, long silence. And when Arnie's dad spoke again, his voice was a near whisper.
It's that goddamn car of his, isn't it?
How much did he suspect? How much did he know? If he was like most people I knew, he'd probably suspected a little more drunk than sober. How much? Even now, I don't know for sure. But what I believe is that he suspected more than anyone. Except maybe Will Darnell.
Yeah, I said. It's the car.
I knew it, he said dully.
I knew. What's happening, Dennis?
How is he doing it, do you know?
Michael, I can't say any more. Will you tell me if he plans a trip tomorrow or the next day?
Yes, he said. Yes, all right.
Thanks.
Dennis, he said. Do you think I'll ever have my son back?
He deserved the truth. That poor, deviled man deserved the truth.
I don't know, I said, and bit at my lower lip until it hurt.
I think that it may have gone too far for that.
Dennis, he almost wailed, what is it? Drugs? Some kind of drugs?
I'll tell you when I can, I said,
That's all I can promise you. I'm sorry. I'll tell you when I can.
Johnny Pemberton was easier to talk to. He was a lively, garrulous man, and any fears I'd had that he wouldn't do business with a kid soon went by the board. I got the feeling that Johnny Pemberton would have done business with Satan, freshly risen from hell with the smell of brimstone still on him, if he had good old legal tender.
Sure, he kept saying. Sure, sure.
You'd no more than started some proposition before Johnny Pemberton was agreeing with you. It was a little unnerving. I had a cover story, but I don't think he even listened to it. He simply quoted me a price. A very reasonable one, as it turned out.
That sounds fine, I said.
Sure, he agreed.
What time you coming by?
Well, how would 9:30 tomorrow?
Sure, he said. See you then.
One other question, Mr. Pemberton.
Sure, and make it Johnny.
Okay, Johnny, then what about automatic transmission? Johnny Pemberton laughed heartily, so heartily that I held the phone away from my ear a bit, feeling glum. That laugh was answer enough.
One of these babies? You gotta be kidding. Why, can't you run a standard shift?
Yes, that's what I learned on, I said.
Sure, so you got no problems, right?
I guess not, I said, thinking of my left leg, which would be running the clutch, or trying to. Simply shifting it around a little tonight had made it ache like hell. I hoped that Arnie would wait a few days before taking his trip out of town, but somehow I didn't think that was in the cards. It would be tomorrow, over the weekend at the latest, and my left leg would simply have to bear up as best it could.
Well, good night, Mr. Pemberton. I'll see you tomorrow. Sure, thanks for calling, kid. I got one all picked out in my mind for you. You'll like her. See if you don't. And if you don't start calling me Johnny, I'm going to double the price.
Sure, I said, and hung up on his laughter. You'll like her. See if you don't. Her again. I was becoming morbidly aware of that casual form of referral, and getting damn sick of it. Then I made my last preparatory call. There were 4 Sykeses in the phone book. I got the one I wanted on my second try. Jimmy himself answered the phone. I introduced myself as Arnie Cunningham's friend, and Jimmy's voice brightened. He liked Arnie, who hardly ever teased him and never punched on him, as Buddy Repperton had done when Buddy worked for Will. He wanted to know how Arnie was, and lying again, I told him Arnie was fine.
"Geez, that's good," he said. "He really had his butt in a sling there for a while. I knew them fireworks and cigarettes was no good for him."
"It's Arnie I'm calling for," I said. "You remember when Will got arrested and they shut down the garage, Jimmy?"
"Sure do," Jimmy sighed. "Now poor old Will's dead and I'm out of a job. My ma keeps saying I gotta go to the vocational technical school, but I wouldn't be no good at that. I guess I'll go for being a janitor or something like that. My Uncle Fred's a janitor up to the college, and he says there's an opening because this other janitor, he disappeared, just took off or something, and
Arnie says when they closed down the garage, he lost his whole socket wrench kit," I broke in. "It was up behind some of those old tires, you know, on the overhead racks. He put them up there so no one would rip him off."
"Still there?" Jimmy asked. "I guess so. What a bummer."
"You know it. That set of bolt fuckers was worth $100.
"Holy crow. I bet they ain't there anymore anyway, though. I bet one of them cops got it."
"Arnie thinks they might still be there, but he's not supposed to go near the garage because of the trouble he's in." This was a lie, but I didn't think Jimmy would catch it, and he didn't. Putting one over on a fellow who was borderline retarded didn't add a thing to my self-esteem, however.
"Oh, shit. Well, listen, I'll go down and look for him. Yes, sir, tomorrow morning, first thing. I still got my keys."
I breathed a sigh of relief. It wasn't Arnie's mythical set of socket wrenches that I wanted. I wanted Jimmy's keys.
"I'd like to get them, Jimmy. That's the thing, as a surprise. And I know right where he put them. You might hunt around all day and still not find them."
"Oh, yeah, for sure. I was never no good at finding things. That's what Will said. He always said I couldn't find my own behind with both hands and a flashlight."
"Oh, man, he was just putting you down. But really, I'd like to do it."
"Well, sure.
I thought I'd come by tomorrow and borrow your keys. I could get that set of wrenches and have your keys back to you before dark."
"Gee, I don't know. Will said to never loan out my keys."
"Sure, before, But the place is empty now, except for Arnie's tools and a bunch of junk out back. The estate will be putting it up for sale pretty soon. Contents complete, and if I take them after that, it would be like stealing.
Oh. Well, I guess it'd be okay. If you bring my keys back.
And then he said, an absurdly touching thing.
See, they're all I got to remember Will by.
It's a promise.
Okay,
he said.
If it's for Arnie, I guess it's okay.
Just before bed, now downstairs, I made one final call to a very sleepy-sounding Lee. One of these next few nights, we're gonna end it. You game?
Yes, she said. I am. I think I am. What have you got planned, Dennis?
So I told her, going through it step by step, half expecting her to poke a dozen holes in my idea. But when I was done, she simply said,
What if it doesn't work?
You make the honor roll. I don't think you need me to draw you a picture.
No, she said. I guess not.
I'd keep you out of it if I could, I said. But LeBay is gonna suspect a trap, so the bait has to be good.
I wouldn't let you leave me out of it, she said. Her voice was steady. This is my business, too. I loved him. I really did. And once you start loving someone, I don't think you ever really get over it completely. Do you, Dennis?
I thought of the years. The summers of reading and swimming and playing games. Monopoly, Scrabble, Chinese checkers. The ant farms. The times I'd kept him from getting killed in all the ways kids like to kill the outsider, the one who's a little bit strange, a little bit off the beat. There had been times when I'd gotten pretty fucking sick of keeping him from getting killed, times when I had wondered if my life wouldn't be easier, better, if I simply let Arnie go, let him drown. But it wouldn't have been better. I had needed Arnie to make me better. And he had. We had traded fair all the way down the line. And oh shit, this was very bitter. Very fucking bitter, indeed.
No,
I said. And I suddenly had to put my hand over my eyes.
I don't think you ever do. I loved him too. And maybe it isn't too late for him, even now.
That's what I would have prayed. Dear God, let me keep Arnie from getting killed just one more time. Just this one last time.
It's not him I hate, she said, her voice low. It's that man, LeBay. Did we really see that thing this afternoon, Dennis? In the car?
Yes, I said. I think we did.
Him and that bitch Christine, she said. Will it be soon?
Soon, yeah, I think so.
All right. I love you, Dennis.
I love you, too. As it turned out, it ended the next day. Friday, the 19th of January. Chapter 49. Arnie. I began that long, terrible day by driving over to Jimmy Sykes's house in my duster. I had expected there might be some trouble from Jimmy's mother, but that turned out to be okay. She was, if anything, mentally slower than her son. She invited me in for bacon and eggs. I declined. My stomach was tied in miserable knots, and clucked over my crutches while Jimmy hunted around in his room for his key ring. I made small talk with Mrs. Sykes, who was roughly the size of Mount Etna, while time passed, and a dismal certainty rose inside me. Jimmy had lost his keys somewhere, and the whole thing was off the rails before it could really begin. He came back, shaking his head.
"Can't find them," he said. "Jeez. I guess I must have lost them somewhere. What a bummer."
And Mrs. Sykes, nearly 300 pounds on the hoof in a faded house dress and her hair up in puffy pink rollers, said with blessed practicality, "Did you look in your pockets, Jim?" A startled expression crossed Jimmy's face. He rammed a hand into the pocket of his green chino work pants. Then, with a shame-faced grin, he pulled out a bunch of keys.
They were on one of the key rings they sell at the novelty shop in the Monroeville Mall, a large rubber fried egg. The egg was dark with grease.
"There you are, you little suckers," he said.
"You watch your language, young man," Mrs. Sykes said. "Just show Dennis which key it is that opens the door and keep your dirty language in your head." Jimmy ended up handing 3 Slage keys over to me, because they weren't labeled, and he couldn't tell which was which. One of them opened the main overhead door, one opened the back overhead door, the one which gave onto the long lot of junked cars, and one opened the door to Will's office. "Thanks," I said. "I'll have these back to you just as soon as I can, Jimmy."
"Great," Jimmy said. "Say hello to Arnie when you see him."
"You bet," I said. "You sure you don't want some bacon and eggs, Dennis?" Mrs. Sykes asked. "There's plenty." "Thanks," I said, "but I really ought to get going." It was 8:15. School started at 9. Arnie usually pulled in around 8:45, Lee had told me. I just had time. I got my crutches under me and got to my feet. "Help him out, Jim," Mrs. Sykes commanded. "Don't just stand there." I started to protest, and she waved me away. "Wouldn't want you to fall in your can getting back to your car, Dennis. Might break your leg all over again." She laughed uproariously at this, and Jimmy, the soul of obedience, practically carried me back to my duster. The sky that day was a scummy, frowsy gray, and the radio was predicting more snow by late afternoon. I drove across town to Libertyville High, took the driveway which led to the student parking lot, and parked in the front row. I didn't need Lee to tell me that Arnie usually parked in the back row. I had to see him, had to strew the bait in front of his nose. But I wanted him as far from Christine as possible when I did it. Away from the car, LeBay's hold seemed weaker. I sat with the key turned over to accessory for the radio and looked at the football field. It seemed impossible that I had ever traded sandwiches with Arnie on those snow-covered bleachers. Impossible to believe that I had run and cavorted on that field myself, dressed up in padding, helmet, and tight pants, stupidly convinced of my own physical invulnerability, perhaps even of my own immortality. I didn't feel that way anymore, if I ever had. Students were coming in, parking their cars and heading for the building, chattering and laughing and horsing around. I slouched lower in my seat, not wanting to be recognized. A bus pulled up at the doors in the main turnaround and disgorged a load of kids. A small cluster of shivering boys and girls gathered out in the smoking area where Buddy had taken Arnie on that day last fall. That day also seemed impossibly distant now. My heart was thumping in my chest and I was miserably tense. A craven part of me hoped that Arnie simply wouldn't show up. And then I saw the familiar white-over-red shape of Christine turn in from School Street and cruise up the student drive, moving at a steady 20, blowing a little plume of white exhaust from her tailpipe. Arnie was behind the wheel, wearing his school jacket. He didn't look at me. He simply drove to his accustomed place at the back of the lot and parked. "Just stay slouched down and he won't even see you," that craven, traitorous part of my mind whispered. "He'll walk right by, like all the rest of them." Instead, I opened my door and fumbled my crutches outside. Leaning my weight on them, I yanked myself out and stood there on the packed snow of the parking lot, feeling a little bit like Fred McMurray in that old picture Double Indemnity. From the school came the burring of the first bell, made faint and unimportant by distance. Arnie was later than he had been in the old days. My mother had said that Arnie was almost disgustingly punctual. Maybe LeBay hadn't been. He came toward me, books under his arm, head down, twisting in and out between the cars. He walked behind a van, passing out of my sight temporarily, and then came back into view. He looked up then, directly into my eyes. His own eyes widened, and he made an automatic half-turn back toward Christine. "Feel kind of naked when you're not behind the wheel?" I asked. He looked back at me. His lips drew slightly downward, as if he had tasted something of unpleasant flavor. "How's your cunt, Dennis?" he asked. George LeBay hadn't said, but he had at least hinted that his brother was extraordinarily good at getting through to people, finding their soft spots. I took 2 shuffling steps forward on my crutches while he stood there, smiling with the corners of his mouth down. "How did you like it when Repperton called you cuntface?" I asked him.
Did you like it so well you want to turn it around and use it on somebody else?
Part of him seemed to flinch at that, something that was maybe only in his eyes. But the contemptuous, watchful smile remained on his lips. It was cold out. I hadn't put on my gloves, and my hands on the crossbars of the crutches were getting numb. Our breath made little plumes.
Or what about in the fifth grade, when Tommy Dechinger used to call you fart breath? I asked, my voice rising. Getting angry at him hadn't been part of the game plan, but now it was here, shaking inside me. Did you like that? And do you remember when Lad Smythe was a patrol boy, and he pushed you down in the street, and I pulled his hat off and stuffed it down his pants? Where you been, Arnie? This guy LeBay is a Johnny-come-lately. Me? I was here all along.
That flinch again. This time he half turned away, the smile faltering, his eyes searching for Christine the way your eyes might search for a loved one in a crowded terminal or bus station, or the way a junkie might look for his pusher.
You need her that bad? I asked. Man, you're hooked right through the fucking bag, aren't you?
I don't know what you're talking about, he said hoarsely.
You stole my girl. Nothing is gonna change that. You went behind my back. You cheated. You're just a shitter, like all the rest of them.
He was looking at me now, his eyes wide and hurt and blazing with anger.
I thought I could trust you, and you turned out to be worse than Repperton or any of them.
He took a step toward me and cried out in a perfect fury of loss.
You stole her, you shitter!
I lurched forward another step on my crutches. One of them slid a little bit in the packed snow underfoot. We were like two reluctant gunslingers approaching each other.
You can't steal what's been given away, I said. What are you talking about?
I'm talking about the night she choked in your car. The night Christine tried to kill her. You told her you didn't need her. You told her to fuck off.
I never did. That's a lie. That's a goddamn lie.
Who am I talking to? I asked.
Never mind.
His gray eyes were huge behind his spectacles.
Never mind who the fuck you're talking to. That's nothing but a dirty lie. No more than I'd expect from that stinking bitch.
Another step closer. His pale face was marked with flaring red patches of color.
When you write your name, it doesn't look like your signature anymore, Arnie. You shut up, Dennis.
Your father says it's like having a stranger in the house.
I'm warning you, man.
Why bother? I asked brutally. I know what's going to happen. So does Lee. The same thing that happened to Buddy Repperton and Will Darnell and all the others. Because you're not Arnie at all anymore. Are you in there, LeBay? Come out and let me see you. I've seen you before. I saw you on New Year's Eve. I saw you yesterday at the chicken place. I know you're in there. Why don't you stop fucking around and come out?
And he did. But in Arnie's face this time. And that was more terrible than all the skulls and skeletons and comic book horrors ever thought of. Arnie's face changed. A sneer bloomed on his lips like a rancid rose, and I saw him as he must have been back when the world was young and a car was all a young man needed to have. Everything else would just automatically follow. I saw George LeBay's big brother. I only remember one thing about him, but I remember that one thing very well. His anger. He was always angry. He came toward me, closing the distance between where he had been and where I stood, propped on my crutches. His eyes were filmy and beyond all reach. That sneer was stamped on his face like the mark of a branding iron.
I had time to think of the scar on George LeBay's forearm, skidding from his elbow to his wrist. He pushed me, and then he came back and threw me. I could hear that 14-year-old LeBay shouting, "You stay out of my way from now on, you goddamn snot-nose! Stay out of my way, you hear?" It was LeBay I was facing now, and he was not a man who took losing easily. Check that, he didn't take losing at all.
"Fight him, Arnie," I said. "He's had his own way too long. Fight him. Kill him. Make him stay."
He swung his foot and kicked my right crutch out from under me. I struggled to stay up, tottered, almost made it, and then he kicked the left crutch away. I fell down on the cold, packed snow. He took another step and stood above me, his face hard and alien.
"You got it coming, and you're gonna get it," he said remotely.
"Yeah,
Right, I gasped. You remember the ant farms, Arnie? Are you in there someplace? This dirty sucker never had a fucking ant farm in his life. He never had a friend in his life.
And suddenly the calm hardness broke. His face roiled. I don't know how else to describe it. LeBay was there, furious at having to put down a kind of internal mutiny. Then Arnie was there, drawn, tired, ashamed, but most of all, desperately unhappy. Then LeBay again, and his foot drew back to kick me as I lay on the snow groping for my crutches and feeling helpless and useless and dumb. Then it was Arnie again, my friend, Arnie, brushing his hair back off his forehead in that familiar distracted gesture. It was Arnie saying, "Oh, Dennis, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry."
"It's too late for sorry, man," I said. I got one crutch and then the other. I pulled myself up little by little, slipping twice before I could get the crutches under me again. Now my hands felt like pieces of furniture. Arnie made no move to help me. He stood with his back against the van, his eyes wide and shocked.
"Dennis, I can't help it," he whispered. "Sometimes I feel like I'm not even here anymore. Help me, Dennis, help me."
"Is LeBay there?" I asked.
"He's always here," Arnie groaned. "Oh, God, always. Except..."
"The car?"
"When Christine... when she goes. Then he's with her. That's the only time he's...
Arnie fell silent. His head slipped over to one side, his chin rolled on his chest in a boneless pivot, his hair dangled towards the snow. Spit ran out of his mouth and splattered on his boots. And then he began to scream thinly and beat his gloved fists on the van behind him.
"Go away! Go away! Go away!"
Then nothing for maybe 5 seconds. Nothing except the shuddering of his body as if a basket of snakes had been dumped inside his clothes. Nothing except that slow, horrible roll of his chin on his chest. I thought maybe he was winning, that he was beating the dirty old son of a bitch. But when he looked up, Arnie was gone. LeBay was there.
"It's all gonna happen just like he said," LeBay told me. "Let it go, boy. Maybe I won't drive over you."
"Come on over to Darnell's tonight," I said. My voice was harsh, my throat as dry as sand.
"We'll play. I'll bring Lee, you bring Christine." "I'll pick my own time and place," LeBay said, and grinned with Arnie's mouth, showing Arnie's teeth, which were young and strong, a mouth still years from the indignity of dentures. "You won't know when or where, but you'll know when the time comes."
"Think again," I said, almost casually. "Come to Darnell's tonight, or she and I start talking tomorrow."
He laughed, an ugly, contemptuous sound.
"And where will that get you? The asylum over at Reed City?"
"Oh, we won't be taken seriously at first," I said. "I'll give you that. But that stuff about how they put you in the loony bin as soon as you start talking about ghosts and demons? LeBay. Maybe in your day, before Flying Saucers and The Exorcist and that house in Amityville. These days, a hell of a lot of people believe in that stuff." He was still grinning, but his eyes looked at me with narrow suspicion. That, and something else. I thought that something else was the first sparkle of fear. "And what you don't seem to realize is how many people know something is wrong." His grin faltered. Of course, he must have realized that and been worried about it. But maybe killing gets to be a fever. Maybe after a while you are simply unable to stop and count the cost. "Whatever weird, filthy kind of life you still have is all wrapped up in that car," I said. "You knew it, and you planned to use Arnie from the very beginning. Except that planned is the wrong word, because you never really planned anything, did you? You just followed your intuitions." He made a snarling sound and turned to go. "You really want to think about it?" I called after him. "Arnie's father knows something is rotten. So does mine.
I think there must be some police somewhere who'd be willing to listen to anything about how their friend Junkins died. And it all comes back to Christine, Christine, Christine. Sooner or later, someone's going to run her through the crusher and back at Darnell's just on general principles. He had turned back and was looking at me with a bright mixture of hate and fear in his eyes. We'll keep talking, and a lot of people will laugh at us, I don't doubt it, but I've got two pieces of cast with Arnie's signature on them. Only one of them isn't his, it's yours. I'll take them to the state cops and keep pestering them until they have a handwriting specialist confirm that. People are going to start watching Arnie. People are going to start watching Christine, too. You get the picture?
Sonny, you don't worry me one fucking bit.
But his eyes said something different. I was getting to him, all right. It's going to happen, I said. People are only rational on the surface. They still toss salt over their left shoulder if they spill the shaker. They don't walk under ladders. They believe in survival after death, and sooner or later, probably sooner, with Lee and me shooting off our mouths, someone is going to turn that car of yours into a sardine can, and I'm willing to bet that when it goes, you'll go with it.
Don't you just wish,
he sneered. We'll be at Darnell's tonight, I said. If you're good, you can get rid of both of us. That won't end it either, but it might give you some breathing space. Time enough to get out of town. But I don't think you're good enough, chum. It's gone on too long. We're getting rid of you. I crutched back to my duster and got in. I used the crutches more clumsily than I had to, tried to make myself look more incapacitated than I really was. I had rocked him by mentioning the signatures. It was time to leave before I overplayed my hand. But there was one more thing. One thing guaranteed to drive LeBay into a frenzy. I pulled my left leg in with my hands, slammed the door, and leaned out. I looked into his eyes and smiled. She's great in bed, I said. Too bad you'll never know. With a furious roar, he charged at me. I rolled up the window and slapped down the door lock. Then, leisurely, I started the engine, while he slammed his gloved fists on the glass. His face was snarling, terrible. There was no Arnie in it now. No Arnie at all. My friend was gone. I felt a dark sorrow that was deeper than tears or fear. But I kept that slow, insulting, dirty grin on my face. Then, slowly, I raised my middle finger to the glass. Fuck you, LeBay, I said, and then pulled out, leaving him to stand there in the lot, shaking with that simple, unswerving fury his brother had told me of. It was that, more than anything else, that I was counting on to bring him tonight. We'd see. Chapter 50. Petunia. I drove about 4 blocks before the reaction set in, and then I had to pull over. I had the shakes, bad. Not even the heater turned up to full could kill them. My breath came in harsh little gasps. I clutched myself to keep warm, but it seemed that I would never be warm again. Never. That face, that horrible face. And Arnie buried somewhere inside. He's always here, Arnie had said. Always except when what? When Christine rolled by herself, of course. LeBay couldn't be both places at the same time. That was beyond even his powers. At last I was able to drive on again, and I wasn't even aware that I had been crying until I looked in the rearview mirror and saw the wet circles under my eyes. It was 10:15 by the time I made it out to Johnny Pomberton's place. He was a tall, broad-shouldered man wearing green gum-rubber boots and a heavy red-and-black checked hunting jacket. An old hat with a grease-darkened bill was tilted up on his balding head as he studied the gray sky.
"More snow coming," the radio says. "Didn't know as you'd really be out, boy, but I brung her around for you just in case. What do you think of her?"
I got my crutches under me again and got out of my car. Road salt gritted under the crutches' rubber tips, but the going felt safe. Standing in front of Johnny Pomberton's woodpile was one of the strangest-looking vehicles I've ever seen in my life. A faint, pungent odor, not exactly pleasant, drifted over from it to where we stood. At one time, far back in its career, it had been a GM product, or so the logo on its gigantic snout advertised. Now, it was a little bit of everything. One thing it surely was, and that was big. The top of its grill would have been head high on a tall man. Behind and over it, the cab loomed like a big square helmet. Behind that, supported by two sets of double wheels on each side, was a long, tubular body, like the body of a gasoline tanker truck. Except that I never saw a tanker truck before this one that was painted bright pink. The word Petunia was written across the side in Gothic letters 2 feet high.
"I don't know what to think of her," I said. "What is she?"
Palmerton poked a Camel cigarette into his mouth and lit it with a quick flick of his horny thumbnail on the tip of a wooden match.
"Cocka sucker," he said.
"What?"
He grinned. 20,000-gallon capacity," he said. "She's a corker, is Petunia."
"I don't get you." But I was starting to. There was an absurd, grisly irony to it that Arnie, the old Arnie, would have appreciated. I had asked Palmerton over the phone if he had a big, heavy truck to rent, and this was the biggest one currently in his yard. All four of his dump trucks were working, two in Libertyville and two others in Philly Hill. He'd had a grader, he explained to me, but it had had a nervous bust down just after Christmas. He said he was having a devilish job keeping his trucks rolling since Darnell's garage shut down. Petunia was essentially a tanker, no more and no less. Her job was pumping out septic systems.
"How much does she weigh?" I asked Palmerton. He flicked away his cigarette. "Dry or loaded with shit?"
I gulped. "Which is it now?" He threw his head back and laughed.
"Do you think I'd rent you a ludded truck?"
He pronounced it ludded truck.
Nah, she's dry. Dry as a bone and all hosed out. Sure she is. Still a little fragrant, though, ain't she?"
I sniffed. She was fragrant, all right.
"It could be a lot worse," I said, "I guess." "Sure," Palmerton said. "You bet. Old Petunia's original pedigree was lost long ago, but what's on her current registration is 18,000 pounds GVW.
"What's that?"
"Gross vehicle weight," he said. "If they pull you over on the interstate, you weigh more than 18,000, the ICC gets upset. Dry, she probably goes around, I don't know, 8,000-9,000 pounds. She's got a 5-speed tranny with a 2-speed differential, giving you 10 forward speeds all told, if you can run a clutch."
He cast a dubious eye up and down my crutches and lit another cigarette.
"Can you run a clutch?"
"Sure," I said, with a straight face, "if it isn't really stiff." But for how long? That was the question.
"Well, that's your business, and I won't mess into it."
He looked at me brightly.
"I'll give you 10% discount for cash on account I don't usually report cash transactions to my favorite uncle."
I checked my wallet and found 420s and 410s.
"How much did you say for one day?" "How does $90 sound?"
I gave it to him. I had been prepared to pay 120.
"What are you going to do with your duster there?"
It hadn't even crossed my mind until just now.
"Could I leave it here just for today?" "Sure," Palmerton said. "You can leave it here all week. I don't give a shit. Just put it around the back and leave the keys in case I have to move it."
I drove around back where there was a wilderness of cannibalized truck parts poking out of the deep snow like bones from white sand. It took me nearly 10 minutes to work my way back around on my crutches. I could have done it faster if I'd used my left leg a bit, but I wouldn't do that. I was saving it for Petunia's clutch. I approached Petunia, feeling dread gather in my stomach like a small black cloud. I had no doubt it would stop Christine if she really showed up at Darnell's garage tonight, and if I could drive the damn truck. I had never driven anything that big in my life, although the summer before I'd gotten some hours in on a bulldozer, and Brad Jeffries had let me try the payloader a couple of times after knocking off for the day. Palmerton stood there in his check jacket, hands stuffed deep into the pockets of his work pants, watching me with wise eyes. I got over to the driver's side, grabbed the door handle, and slipped a little. He took a step or two toward me.
"I can make it."
"Sure," he said. I jammed the crutch into my armpit again, my breath frosting out in quick little gasps, and pulled the door open. Holding onto the door's inside handle with my left hand and balancing on my right leg like a stork, I threw my crutches into the cab and then followed them. The keys were in the ignition, the shift pattern printed on the stick. I slammed the door, pushed the clutch down with my left leg, not much pain, so far so good, and started Petunia up. Her engine sounded like a full field of Stalkers at Philly Plains. Palmerton strolled over.
A little noisy, ain't she?
He yelled.
Sure,
I screamed back.
You know, he bellowed, I don't like hell if you got an eye on your license, boy.
An eye on your license meant that the state had tested you on the big trucks. I had an A for motorcycles, much to my mother's horror, but no I. I grinned down at him.
You never checked because I look trustworthy.
He smiled back.
Sure.
I revved the engine a little. Petunia blew off two brisk backfires that were almost as loud as mortar blasts.
You mind if I ask what you want that truck for? None of my business, I know.
Just what it was meant for, I said.
Begging your pardon?
I want to get rid of some shit, I said. I had something of a scare going downhill from Palmerton's place. Even dry and empty, that baby really got rolling. I seemed incredibly high up, able to look down on the roofs of the cars I passed. Driving through downtown Libertyville, I felt as conspicuous as a baby whale in a goldfish pond. It didn't help any that Palmerton's septic pumper was painted that bright pink color. I got some amused glances. My left leg had begun to ache a little, but running through Petunia's unfamiliar shift pattern in the stop-and-go downtown traffic kept my mind off it. A more surprising ache was developing in my shoulders and across my chest. It came from simply piloting Petunia through traffic. The truck was not equipped with power steering, and that wheel really turned hard. I turned off Main onto Walnut, and then into the parking lot behind the Western Auto. I got carefully down from Petunia's cab, slammed her door. My nose had already become used to the faint odor she gave off, set my crutches under me, and went in the back entrance. I got the three garage keys off Jimmy's ring and took them over to the key-making department. For $180, I got two copies of each. I put the new keys in one pocket, Jimmy's ring with his original keys reattached in the other. I went out the front door onto Main Street and down to Libertyville Lunch, where there was a pay telephone. Overhead, the sky was grayer and more lowering than ever. Palmerton was right. There would be snow. Inside, I ordered a coffee in Danish and got change for the telephone booth. I went inside, closed the door clumsily behind me, and called Lee. She answered on the first ring.
Dennis, where are you?
The Libertyville Lunch. Are you alone?
Yes. Dad's at work and Mom went grocery shopping. Dennis, I almost told her everything. I started thinking about her parking at the A&P and crossing the parking lot and, I don't know, what you said about Arnie leaving town didn't seem to matter. It still made sense, but it didn't seem to matter. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I said, thinking about giving Ellie a lift down to Tom's the night before, even though my leg was aching like hell by then. I know exactly what you mean.
Dennis, it can't go on like this. I'll go crazy. Are we still going to try your idea?
Yes, I said. Leave your mom a note, Lee. Tell her you have to be gone for a little while. Don't say any more than that. When you're not home for supper, your folks will probably call mine. Maybe they'll decide we ran off and eloped.
Maybe that's not such a bad idea, she said,
and laughed in a way that gave me prickles.
I'll see you.
Hey, one other thing. Is there any painkiller in your house? Darvon, anything like that?
There's some Darvon from the time Dad threw his back out, she said. Is it your leg, Dennis?
It hurts a little.
How much is a little?
It's really okay.
No BS?
No BS. And after tonight, I'll give it a nice long rest, okay?
Okay.
Get here as quick as you can. She came in as I was ordering a second cup of coffee, wearing a fur-fringed parka and a pair of faded jeans. The jeans were tucked into battered fry boots. She managed to look both sexy and practical. Heads turned.
Looking good, I said, and kissed her temple.
She passed me a bottle of gray and pink gel capsules.
You don't look so hot, though, Dennis. Here.
The waitress, a woman of about 50 with iron gray hair, came over with my coffee. The cup sat placidly, an island in a small brown pond in the saucer.
Why aren't you kids in school? She asked.
Special dispensation, I said gravely.
She stared at me.
Coffee, please?
Lee said, pulling off her gloves. As the waitress went back behind the counter with an audible sniff, she leaned toward me and said,
It would be pretty funny if we got picked up by the truant officer, wouldn't it?
Hilarious, I said, thinking that, in spite of the radiance the cold had given her, Lee really wasn't looking all that good. I didn't think either of us really would be until this thing was over. There were small strain lines around her eyes, as if she had slept poorly the night before.
So, what do?
We get rid of it, I said. Wait until you see your chariot, madam.
My God,
Lee said, staring at Petunia's hot pink magnificence. It hulked silently in the Western Auto parking lot, dwarfing a Chevy van on one side and a Volkswagen on the other.
What is it?
Cock-a-sucker, I said, with a straight face. She looked at me, puzzled, and then she burst into hysterical gales of laughter. I wasn't sorry to see it happen. When I had told her about my confrontation with Arnie in the student parking lot that morning, those strain lines on her face had grown deeper and deeper, her lips whitening as they pressed together. I know that it looks sort of ridiculous, I said now.
That's putting it mildly, she replied, still giggling and hiccuping.
But it'll do the job if anything will.
Yes. Yes, I suppose it should. And it's not exactly unfitting, is it?
I nodded. I had that thought.
Well, let's get in, she said. I'm cold.
She climbed up into the cab ahead of me, her nose wrinkling.
Agh, she said.
I smiled. You get used to it. I handed her my crutches and climbed laboriously up behind the wheel. The pain in my left leg had subsided from a series of sharp clawings to a dull throb again. I had taken to Darvon back in the restaurant.
Dennis, is your leg gonna be all right?
It'll have to be, I said, and slammed the door. Chapter 51. Christine. It was 11:30 or so when we pulled out of the Western Auto parking lot. The first spats of snow were coming down. I drove across town to the Sykes' house, shifting easily now as the Darvon took hold. The house was dark and locked. Mrs. Sykes may be at work, Jimmy may be off collecting his unemployment or something. Lee found a crumpled-up envelope in her handbag, scratched off her address, and wrote Jimmy Sykes across the front in her slanting, pretty hand. She put Jimmy's key ring into the envelope, folded the flap, and slipped it through the letter slot in the front door. While she did that, I let Petunia idle in neutral, resting my leg.
What now? She asked, climbing back into the cab.
Another phone call, I said. Out near the intersection of JFK Drive and Crescent Avenue, I found a telephone booth. I got carefully out of the truck, holding on until Lee handed down my crutches. Then I made my way carefully through the thickening snow to the booth. Seen through the dirty phone booth glass and the swirling snow, Petunia looked like some strange pink dinosaur. I called Horlicks University and went through the switchboard to get Michael's office. Arnie had told me once that his dad was a real office drone, always brown bagging it at lunch and staying in. Now, as the phone was picked up on the second ring, I blessed him for it.
"Dennis, I tried to reach you at home. Your mom said..."
"Where's he going?" My stomach was cold. It wasn't until then, at that exact moment, that all of it began to seem completely real to me, and I began to think that this crazy confrontation was going to come off.
"How did you know he was going? You've got to tell me. I don't have time for questions, and I couldn't answer them anyway. Where is he going?"
Slowly, he said, "He and Regina are going to Penn State this afternoon, right after school. Arnie called her this morning and asked her if she'd go with him. He said..." He paused, thinking. "He said he felt as if he'd suddenly come to his senses. He said it just sort of hit him as he was going to school this morning, that if he didn't do something definite about college, it might slip away from him. He told her he'd decided Penn State was the best bet, and asked her if she'd like to go up with him and talk to the dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, and to some of the people in the history and philosophy departments." The booth was cold. My hands were starting to go numb. Lee was high up in Petunia's wheelhouse, watching me anxiously. "How well you arranged things, Arnie," I thought. Still the chess player. He was manipulating his mother, putting her on strings and making her dance.
I felt some pity for her, but not as much as I might have felt. How many times had Regina herself been the manipulator, dancing others across her stage like so many Punch and Judy's? Now, while she was half-distracted with fear and shame, LeBay had dangled in front of her eyes the one thing absolutely guaranteed to make her come running. The possibility that things might just be returning to normal.
"And did all that ring true to you?" I asked Michael.
"Of course not," he burst out. "It wouldn't have rung true to her if she was thinking straight. With college admissions what they are today, Penn State would enroll him in July if he had the money for tuition and the college board scores. And Arnie has both. He talked as if this were the 50s instead of the 70s.
"When are they leaving?"
"She's going to meet him at the high school after period 6. That's what she said when she called me. He's getting a dismissal slip." That meant they would be leaving Libertyville in less than an hour and a half, so I asked the last question, even though I already knew the answer.
"They're not taking Christine, are they?"
"No, they're going in the station wagon. She was delirious with joy, Dennis, delirious. That business of getting her to go with him to Penn State, that was inspired. Wild horses wouldn't have kept Regina from a chance like that. Dennis, what's going on? Please!"
"Tomorrow," I said. "That's a promise. Firm. Meantime, you've got to do something for me. It could be a matter of life and death for my family and for Lee Cabot's family. You..."
"Oh, my God," he said hoarsely. He spoke in the voice of a man for whom a great light has just dawned. "He's been gone every time. Except when that Welch boy was killed, and that time he was... Regina saw him asleep, and I'm sure she wasn't lying about that. Dennis, who's driving that car? Who's using Christine to kill people when Arnie isn't here?" I almost told him, but it was cold in the telephone booth, and my leg was starting to ache again, and that answer would have led to other questions, dozens of them, and even then the only final result might be a flat refusal to believe.
"Michael, listen," I said, speaking with all the deliberateness I could summon. For one weird moment, I felt like Mr. Rogers on TV. "A big car from the 1950s is coming to eat you up, boys and girls. Can you say Christine? I knew you could. You've got to call my father and Lee's father. Have both families get together at Lee's house." I was thinking of Brick, good, solid Brick.
"I think maybe you ought to go too, Michael. All of you stay together until Lee and I get there or until I call. But you tell them for Lee and me. They're not to go outside after..."
I calculated. If Arnie and Regina left the high school at 2, how long before his alibi would be cast iron watertight?
"After 4 o'clock this afternoon. After 4, none of you go out on the street. Any street, under no circumstances."
"Dennis, I can't just..."
"You have to," I said. "You'll be able to convince my old man, and between the two of you, you should be able to convince Mr. and Mrs. Cabot. And stay away from Christine yourself, Michael."
"They're leaving right from school," Michael said. "He said the car would be all right in the school parking lot." I could hear it in his voice again, his knowledge of the lie. After what had happened last fall, Arnie would no more leave Christine in a public parking lot than he would show up in calc class naked.
"Uh-huh," I said. "But if you happen to look out the window and see her in the driveway anyhow, stay clear, do you understand?"
"Yes, but call my father first. Promise me."
"All right, I promise. But Dennis..."
"Thank you, Michael." I hung up.
My hands and feet were numb with the cold, but my forehead was slick with sweat. I pushed the door of the phone booth open with the tip of one crutch and worked my way back to Petunia.
"What did he say?" Lee asked. "Did he promise?"
"Yes," I said. "He promised. And my dad will see that they get together. I'm pretty sure of that. If Christine goes for anyone tonight, it'll have to be us."
"All right," she said. "Good."
I threw Petunia into gear and we rumbled away. The stage was set. As well as I could set it, anyway. And now there was really nothing to do but wait and see what would come. We drove across town to Darnell's garage through steady, light snow, and I pulled into the parking lot at just past one that afternoon. The long, rambling building with its corrugated steel sides was totally deserted, and Petunia's belly-high wheels cut through the deep, unplowed snow to stop in front of the main door. The signs bolted to that door were the same as they had been on that long-ago August evening when Arnie first drove Christine there. Save money. Your know-how, our tools. Garage space rented by the week, month, or year, and honk for entry. But the only one that really meant anything was the new one, leaning in the darkened office window. Closed until further notice. Sitting in one corner of the snowy front lot was an old crumpled Mustang, one of the real doorsuckers from the 60s. Now it sat silent and broody under a shroud of snow.
It's creepy, Lee said in a low voice.
Yeah, it sure is. I gave her the keys I'd made at the Western Auto that morning. One of these will do it. She took the keys, got out, and walked over to the door. I kept an eye in both rearview mirrors while she fumbled at the lock, but we didn't seem to be attracting any undue attention. I suppose there was a certain psychology involved in seeing such a big, conspicuous vehicle. It makes the idea of something clandestine or illegal harder to swallow. Lee suddenly tugged hard on the door, stood up, tugged again, and then came back to the truck.
I got the key to turn, but I can't get the door up, she said. I think it's frozen to the ground or something.
Great, I thought. Wonderful. None of this was going to come easily.
Dennis, I'm sorry, she said, seeing it on my face.
No, it's all right, I said. I opened the driver's door and performed another of my comical sliding exits.
Be careful, she said anxiously, walking beside me with her arm around my waist as I crutched carefully through the snow to the door. Remember your leg.
Yes, mother, I said, grinning a little. I stood in profile to the door when I got there, so I could bend down to the right and keep my weight off my bad leg. Bent over in the snow, left leg in the air, left hand holding onto my crutches, right hand grasping the roll-up door's handle. I must have looked like a circus contortionist. I pulled and felt the door give a little, but not quite enough. She was right. It had iced up pretty good along the bottom. You could hear it crackling. Grab on and help me, I said. Lee placed both of her hands over my right hand, and we pulled together. That crackling sound became a little louder, but still the ice wouldn't quite give up its grip on the foot of the door. We've almost got it, I said. My right leg was throbbing unpleasantly, and sweat was running down my cheeks. I'll count. On three, give it all you got, okay?
Yes, she said.
One, two, three! What happened was the door came free of the ice all at once, with absurd, deadly ease. It flew upward on its tracks, and I stumbled backward, my crutches flying. My left leg folded underneath me, and I landed on it. The deep snow cushioned the fall somewhat, but I still felt the pain in a kind of silver bolt that seemed to ram upward from my thigh all the way to my temples and back down again. I clenched my teeth over a scream, barely keeping it in, and then Lee was on her knees in the snow beside me, her arm around my shoulders.
Dennis, are you all right?
Help me up.
She had to do most of the pulling, and both of us were gasping like winded runners by the time I was on my feet again, with my crutches propped under me. Now I really needed them. My left leg was in agony.
Dennis, you won't be able to work the clutch in that truck now.
Yeah, I will. Help me back, Lee.
You're as white as a ghost. I think we ought to get you to a doctor.
No, help me back.
Dennis,
Lee, help me back.
We inched our way back to Petunia through the snow, leaving shuffling, troubled tracks in the snow behind us. I reached up, laid hold of the steering wheel, and did a chin-up to get in, scraping feebly at the running board with my right leg. And still in the end, Lee had to get behind me and put both hands on my keister and shove. At last I was behind Petunia's wheel, hot and shivering with pain. My shirt was wet with snowmelt and sweat. Until that day in January of 1979, I don't think I knew how much pain can make you sweat. I tried to jam down the clutch with my left foot, and that silver bolt of pain came again, making me throw my head back and grind my teeth until it subsided a little.
Dennis, I'm going down the street and find a phone and call a doctor.
Her face was white and scared.
You broke it again, didn't you?
when you fell?
I don't know, I said. But you can't do that, Lee. It'll be your folks or mine if we don't end it now. You know that. LeBay won't stop. He has a well-developed sense of vengeance. We can't stop.
But you can't drive it, she wailed.
She looked up into the cab at me, crying now. The hood of her parka had fallen back in our mutual struggle to get me up into the driver's seat, where I now sat in magnificent uselessness. I could see a scatter of snowflakes in her dark blonde hair.
Go inside there, I said. See if you can find a broom or a long stick of wood.
What good will that do? She asked, crying harder. Just get it and then we'll see. She went into the dark maw of the open door and disappeared from view. I held onto my leg and sparred with terror. If I really had broken my leg again, there was a good chance I'd be wearing a built-up heel on my left foot for the rest of my life. But there might not even be that much of my life left if we couldn't put a stop to Christine. Now there was a cheery thought. Lee came back with a push broom.
Will this do? She asked.
To get us inside, yes, then we'll see if we can find something better. The handle was the type that unscrews. I got hold of it, unthreaded it, and tossed the bristle end aside. Holding it in my left hand along my side, just another goddamn crutch, I pushed down the clutch with it. It held for a moment, then slipped off. The clutch sprang back up. The top of the handle almost bashed me in the mouth. Looking good, Gilder, but it would have to do. Come on, get in, I said.
Dennis, are you sure?
As sure as I can be, I said. She looked at me for a moment, and then nodded.
Okay.
She went around to the passenger side and got in. I slammed my own door, depressed Petunia's clutch with the broom handle, and geared into first. I had the clutch halfway out, and Petunia was just starting to roll forward when the broom handle slipped off the clutch again. The septic tanker ran inside Darnell's garage with a series of neck-snapping jerks, and when I slammed my right foot down on the brake, the truck stalled. We were mostly inside.
Lee, I've got to have something with a wider foot, I said. This broom handle won't cut it.
I'll see what there is.
She got out and began to walk around the edge of the garage floor, hunting. I stared around. Creepy, Lee had said, and she was right. The only cars left were four or five old soldiers, so gravely wounded that no one had cared enough to claim them. All the rest of the slant spaces, with their numbers stenciled in white paint, were empty. I glanced at stall 20, and then glanced away. The overhead tire racks were likewise nearly empty. A few baldies remained, heeled over against one another like giant donuts blackened in a fire, but that was all. One of the two lifts was partially up, with a wheel rim caught beneath it. The front-end alignment chart on the right-hand wall glimmered faintly red and white, the two headlight targets like bloodshot eyes, and shadows. Shadows everywhere. Overhead, big box-shaped heaters pointed their louvers this way and that, roosting up there like weird bats. It seemed very much like a death place. Lee had used another of Jimmy's keys to open Will's office. I could see her moving back and forth in there through the window Will had used to look out at his customers. Those working Joes who had to keep their cars running so they could blah, blah, blah. She flipped some switches, and the overhead fluorescents came on in snow-cold ranks. So the electric company hadn't cut off the juice. I'd have to have her turn the lights off again. We couldn't afford to risk attracting attention, but at least we could have some heat. She opened another door and disappeared temporarily from view. I glanced at my watch. 1:30 now. She came back, and I saw that she was holding an O-cedar mop, the kind with the wide yellow sponge along the foot.
Would this be any good?
Only perfect, I said. Get in, kiddo, we're in business. She climbed up once more, and I pushed the clutch down with the mop. Lots better, I said. Where did you find it?
In the bathroom, she said, and wrinkled her nose.
Bad in there?
Dirty, reeking of cigars, and there's a whole pile of moldy books in the corner, the kind they sell at those little hole-in-the-wall stores.
So that was what Darnell left behind him, I thought. An empty garage, a pile of beeline books, and a phantom reek of Roy Tan cigars. I felt cold again, and thought that if I had my way, I'd see this place bulldozed flat and pasted over with hot top.
I could not shake the feeling that it was an unmarked grave of a sort, the place where LeBay and Christine had killed my friend's mind and taken over his life.
"I can't wait to get out of here," Lee said, looking around nervously.
"Really? I kind of like it. I was thinking of moving in." I caressed her shoulder and looked deeply into her eyes.
"We could start a family," I breathed. She held up a fist. "Want me to start a nosebleed?"
"Nah, that's all right. For what it's worth, I can't wait to get out of here either." I drove Petunia the rest of the way inside. I found that I could run the clutch pretty well using the O-seater mop, in first gear at least. The handle had a tendency to bend, and I would have preferred something thicker, but it would have to do unless we could find something better in the meantime. "We've got to turn off the lights again," I said, killing the engine. "The wrong people might see them." She got out and turned them off while I swung Petunia in a wide circle and then carefully backed it up until the rear end almost touched the window between the garage and Darnell's office. Now the big truck's snout was pointing directly back at the open overhead door through which we had entered. With the lights off, the shadows descended again. The light coming in through the open door was weak, muted by the snow, white and without strength. It spread on the oil-stained, cracked concrete like a pie wedge and simply died halfway across the floor.
"I'm cold, Dennis," Lee called from Darnell's office. "He's got the switches for the heat marked. Can I turn them on?"
"Go ahead," I called back. A moment later, the garage whispered with the sound of the blowers. I leaned back against the seat, gently running my hands over my left leg. The material of my jeans was stretched smoothly over the thigh, tight and without a wrinkle. The son of a bitch was swelling. And it hurt. Christ, did it hurt. Lee came back and climbed up beside me. She told me again how terrible I looked, and for some reason my mind cross-patched, and I thought of the afternoon Arnie had brought Christine down here, of the bebop queen's husband yelling for Arnie to get that hunk of junk out from in front of his house, and of Arnie telling me the guy was a regular Robert Deadford, how we'd gotten the giggles. I closed my eyes against the sting of tears. With nothing to do but wait, time slowed down. It was 1:45, then 2:00. Outside, the snow had thickened a little, but not much. Lee got out of the truck and pushed the button that trundled the door back down. That made it even darker inside. She came back, climbed up, and said, "There's a funny gadget on the side of the door. See it? It looks just like the electronic garage door opener we used to have when we lived in Weston." I sat up suddenly, stared at it. "Oh," I said, "oh, Jesus.
What's the matter?"
"That's just what it is, a garage door opener. And there's one of the transmitter gadgets on Christine. Arnie mentioned that to me Thanksgiving night. You've got to break it, Lee. Use the handle of that push broom." She got down again, picked up the broom handle, and stood below the electric eye gadget, looking up and bashing at it with the handle. She looked like a woman trying to kill a bug near the ceiling. At last, she was rewarded with a crunch of plastic and tinkle of glass. She came back slowly, tossing the broom handle aside, and got up beside me.
"Dennis, don't you think it's time you told me exactly what you've got in mind?"
"What do you mean?"
"You know what I mean," she said, and pointed at the closed overhead door. 5 square windows in a line 3/4 of the way up its height let in minimal light through dirty glass. "When it gets dark, you plan to open that door again, don't you?"
I nodded. The door itself was wood, but it was braced with hinged steel strips, like the inner gate of an old-time elevator. I'd let her in, but once that door was shut, Christine wouldn't be able to bash her way back out again. I hoped. It made me cold to think how close we'd come to overlooking the electronic door opener. Open the door at dusk. Yes. Let Christine in. Yes. Close the door again. Then I would use Petunia to batter her to death.
"Okay," she said. "That's the trap. But once she... it comes in, how are you going to get that door shut again to keep her in? Maybe there's a button in Darnell's office that does it, but I didn't see it."
"So far as I know, there isn't one," I said. "So you're going to be standing over there by the button that shuts the door. I pointed. The manual button was located on the right side of the door, about 2 feet below the ruins of the electric door opener box. You'll be against the wall, out of sight. When Christine comes in, always assuming she does, you're going to push the button that starts the door coming down, and then step outside in a hurry. The door comes down, and bam, the trap's shut. Her face set.
On you as well as her. In the words of the immortal Wordsworth, that sucks.
That's Coleridge, not Wordsworth. There's no other way to do it, Lee.
If you're still inside when that door comes down, Christine is going to run you down. Even if there was a button in Darnell's office, well, you saw in the paper what happened to the side of his house.
Her face was stubborn.
Park over by the switch, and when she comes in, I'll reach out the window and hit the button and lower the door.
If I park there, I'll be in sight, and if this tank is in sight, she won't come in.
I don't like it, she burst out. I don't like leaving you alone. It's like you tricked me.
In a way, that's just what I had done. And for whatever it's worth, I would not do it the same way now. But I was going on 18 then, and there's no male chauvinist pig like an 18-year-old male chauvinist pig. I put an arm around her shoulders. She resisted stiffly for a moment and then came to me.
There's just no other way, I said. If it wasn't for my leg, or if you could drive a standard shift.
I shrugged.
I'm scared for you, Dennis. I want to help.
You'll be helping plenty. You're the one that's really in danger, Lee. You'll be outside, on the floor, when she comes in. I'm just going to sit up here in the cab and beat that bitch back into component parts.
I only hope it works that way, she said, and put her head on my chest. I touched her hair.
So we waited.
In my mind's eye, I could see Arnie coming out of the main building at LHS, books under his arm. I could see Regina waiting for him there in the Cunninghams' compact wagon, radiant with happiness. Arnie smiling remotely and submitting to her embrace. Arnie, you've made the right decision. You don't know how relieved, how happy your father and I are.
Yes, Mom.
Do you want to drive, honey?
No, you drive, Mom. That's okay. The two of them setting off for Penn State through the light snow. Regina driving, Arnie sitting in the shotgun seat with his hands folded stiffly in his lap, his face pale and unsmiling and clear of acne. And back in the student parking lot at LHS, Christine sitting silently in the driveway, waiting for the snow to thicken, waiting for dark. At 3:30 or so, Lee went back through Darnell's office to use the bathroom, and while she was gone, I dry-swallowed two more Darvon. My leg was a steady, leaden agony. Shortly after that, I lost coherent track of time. The dope had me fuddled, I guess. The whole thing began to seem dreamlike. The deepening shadows, the white light coming in through the windows slowly changing to an ashy gray, the drone of the overhead heaters. I think that Lee and I made love, not in the ordinary way, not with my leg the way it was, but some kind of sweet substitute. I seem to remember her breath steepening in my ear until she was nearly panting. I seem to remember her whispering for me to be careful, to please be careful, that she had lost Arnie and could not bear to lose me, too. I seem to remember an explosion of pleasure that made the pain disappear in a brief but total way that not all the Darvon in the world could manage. But brief was the right word. It was all too brief. And then, I think, I dozed. The next thing I remember for sure was Lee shaking me fully awake and whispering my name over and over in my ear.
What?
I was spaced out, and my leg was full of a glassy pain, simply waiting to explode. There was an ache in my temples, and my eyes felt too big for their sockets. I blinked around at Lee like a large, stupid owl.
It's dark, she said. I thought I heard something.
I blinked again and saw that she looked drawn and frightened. Then I glanced toward the door and saw that it was standing open.
How the hell did that... Me, she said. I opened it.
Cripes, I said, straightening up a little and wincing at the pain in my leg.
That wasn't too smart, Lee. If she had come...
She didn't, Lee said.
It started to get dark, that's all, and to snow harder. So I got out and opened the door, and then I came back here. I kept thinking you'd wake up in a minute. You were mumbling, and I kept thinking, I'll wait until it's really dark. I'll just wait until it's really dark. And then I saw I was fooling myself, because it's been dark for almost half an hour now, and I was only thinking I could still see some light. Because I wanted to see it, I guess. And just now, I thought I heard something.
Her lips began to tremble, and she pressed them tightly together. I looked at my watch and saw that it was 5:45. If everything had gone right, my parents and sister would be together with Michael and Lee's folks now. I looked through Petunia's windshield at the square of snow-shot darkness where the garage entrance was. I could hear the wind shrieking. A thin creeper of snow had already blown in onto the cement.
"You just heard the wind," I said uneasily. "It's walking and talking out there." "Maybe, but..."
I nodded reluctantly. I didn't want her to leave the safety of Petunia's high cab, but if she didn't go now, maybe she never would. I wouldn't let her, and she would let me not let her, and then, when and if Christine came, all she would have to do would be to reverse back out of Darnell's. And wait for a more opportune time. "Okay," I said. "But remember, stand back in that little niche to the right of the door. If she comes, she may just stand outside for a while." Scenting the air like an animal, I thought. "Don't get scared. Don't move. Don't let her freak you into giving yourself away. Just be cool and wait until she comes in. Then push that button and get the hell out. Do you understand?"
"Yes," she whispered. "Dennis, will this work?"
"It should, if she comes at all."
"I won't see you until it's over."
"I guess that's so." She leaned over, placed her left hand lightly on the side of my neck, and kissed my mouth.
"Be careful, Dennis,"
she said.
"But kill it. It's really not a she at all. Just an it. Kill it."
"I will," I said. She looked in my eyes and nodded.
"Do it for Arnie," she said. "Set him free."
I hugged her hard, and she hugged me back. Then she slid across the seat. She hit her little handbag with her knee, and it fell to the floor of the cab. She paused, head cocked, a startled, thoughtful look in her eyes. Then she smiled, bent over, picked it up, and began to rummage quickly through it.
"Dennis," she said, "do you remember the Morte d'Arthur?"
"A little." One of the classes Lee and Arnie and I had all shared before my football injury was Fudgy Bowen's Classics of English Literature, and one of the first things we had been faced with in there was Mallory's Morte d'Arthur. Why Lee asked me this now was a mystery to me. She had found what she wanted. It was a filmy pink scarf, nylon, the sort of thing a girl wears over her head on a day when a misty sort of rain is falling. She tied it around the left forearm of my parka.
"What the hell?"
I asked, smiling a little.
"Be my knight,"
she said, and smiled back. But her eyes were serious.
"Be my knight, Dennis."
I picked up the squeegee mop she had found in Will's bathroom and made a clumsy salute with it. "Sure," I said. "Just call me Sir O'Cedar."
"Joke about it if you want," she said. "But don't really joke about it, okay?"
"All right," I said. "If it's what you want, I'll be your parfait goddamn gentle knight." She laughed a little, and that was better. "Remember about that button, kiddo. Push it hard. We don't want that door to just burp once and stop on its track. No escapes, right?"
"Right."
She got out of Petunia, and I can close my eyes now and see her as she was then, in that clean and silent moment, just before everything went terribly wrong. A tall, pretty girl with long blonde hair the color of raw honey, slim hips, long legs, and those striking Nordic cheekbones, now wearing a ski parka and faded Lee Riders, moving with a dancer's grace. I can still see it, and I still dream about it, because, of course, while we were busy setting up Christine, she was busy setting us up. That old and infinitely wise monster. Did we really think we could outsmart her so easily? I guess we did. My dreams are in terrible slow motion.
I can see the softly lovely motion of her hips as she walks. I can hear the hollow click of her fry boots on the oil-stained cement floor. I can even hear the soft, dry whish-whish of her parka's quilted inner lining brushing against her blouse. She's walking slowly, and her head is up. Now she is the animal, but no predator. She walks with the cautious grace of a zebra approaching a waterhole at dusk. It is the walk of an animal that scents danger. I try to scream to her through Petunia's windshield. Come back, Lee! Come back quick! You were right! You heard something! She's out there now! Out there in the snow with her headlights off! Crouch down! Lee, come back! She stopped suddenly, her hands tensing into fists. And that was when sudden, savage circles of light sprang to life in the snowy dark outside. They were like white eyes opening. Lee froze, hideously exposed on the open floor. She was 30 feet inside the door and slightly to the right of center. She turned toward the headlights, and I could see the dazed, uncertain expression on her face. I was just as stunned, and that first vital moment passed unused. Then the headlights sprang forward, and I could see the dark, low-slung shape of Christine behind them. I could hear the mounting, furious howl of her engine as she leaped toward us from across the street where she had been waiting all along, maybe even since before dark. Snow funneled back from her roof and skirled across her windshield in filmy nets that were almost instantly melted by the defroster. She hit the tarmac leading up to the entrance, still gaining speed. Her engine was a V8 scream of rage. Lee! I screamed and clawed for Petunia's ignition switch. Lee broke to the right and ran for the wall button. Christine roared inside as she reached it and pushed it. I heard the rattle rumble of the overhead door descending on its track. Christine came in angling to the right, going for Lee. She dug a great clout of dry wood and splinters from the wall. There was a metallic screech as part of her right bumper pulled loose, a sound like a drunk scream of laughter. Sparks cascaded across the floor as she went into a long, slewing turn. She missed Lee, but she wouldn't when she went back. Lee was stuck in that right-hand corner with nowhere to hide. She might be able to make it outside, but I was terribly afraid that the door wasn't coming down fast enough to cut off Christine. The descending door might peel off her roof, but that wouldn't stop her, and I knew it. Petunia's engine bellowed, and I dragged out the headlight button. Her brights came on, splashing over the closing door and over Lee. She was backed up against the wall, her eyes wide. Her parka took on a weird, almost electric blue color in the headlights, and my mind informed me with sickening and clinical accuracy that her blood would look purple. I saw her glance upward for a moment and then back down at Christine. The Fury's tires screamed violently as she leaped at Lee. Smoke rose from the new black marks on the concrete. I just had time to register the fact that there were people inside of Christine, a whole carload of them. At the same instant that Christine roared toward her, Lee leaped upward with a big, ungainly jack-in-the-box spring. My mind, seeming to run at a speed approaching light, wondered for a moment if she was intending to leap right over the Plymouth, as if instead of fries, she wore boots of the Seven League variety. Instead, she caught and gripped the rusted metal struts, which supported an overhead shelf almost 9 feet above the floor, over 3 feet above her head. This shelf skirted all four walls. On the night Arnie and I had first brought Christine in, that entire shelf had been crammed with recapped tires and old Baldies waiting to be recapped. In some funny way, it had reminded me of a well-stocked library shelf. Now, it was mostly empty. Holding those angled struts, Lee swung her jeaned legs up like a kid who meant to throw his legs right over his own shoulders, what we used to call skinning the cat in grammar school. Christine's snout smashed into the wall directly below her. If she had been any slower getting her legs up, they would have been mashed off at the knees. A piece of chrome flew. Two of the remaining tires tumbled from the shelf and bounced crazily on the cement like giant rubber donuts. Lee's head smashed back against the wall with battering, dazing force as Christine reversed, all four of her tires laying rubber and squirting blue smoke. And what was I doing all this time, you wonder? It wasn't all that time. That is my answer. Even as I used the O-Cedar mop to depress Petunia's clutch and gear into first, the overhead door was just thumping down. All of it had happened in the space of seconds.
Lee was still holding on to the struts supporting the tire shelf, but now she only hung there, head down, dazed. I let the clutch out, and a cold part of my mind took over. Easy, man. If you pop the clutch and stall this fucker, she's dead. Petunia rolled. I revved the engine up to a bellow and let the clutch out all the way. Christine roared at Lee again, her hood crimped almost double from her first hit, bright metal showing through the broken paint at the sharpest points of bend. It looked as if her hood and grill had grown shark's teeth. I hit Christine 3/4 of the way toward the front, and she slid around, one of her tires pulling off the rim. The 58 slammed into a litter of old bumper jacks and junk parts in one corner. There was a booming crash as she struck the wall, and then the hot sound of her engine, revving and falling off, revving and falling off. The entire left front end was bashed in, but she was still running. I slammed on Petunia's brake with my right foot and barely managed to avoid crushing Lee myself. Petunia's engine stalled. Now the only sound in the garage was Christine's screaming engine. "Lee!" I screamed over it. "Lee, run!" She looked over at me groggily, and now I could see sticky braids of blood in her hair. It was as purple as I had expected. She let go of the struts, landed on her feet, staggered, and went to one knee. Christine came for her. Lee got up, took 2 wobbling steps, and got on her blind side, behind Petunia. Christine swerved and struck the truck's front end. I was thrown roughly to the right. Pain roared through my left leg. "Get up!" I screamed at Lee, trying to lean even farther over and open the door. "Get up!" Christine backed off, and when she came again, she cut hard to the right and went out of my line of vision, around the back of Petunia. I caught just a glimpse of her in the rearview mirror, bolted outside the driver's side window. Then I could only hear the scream of her tires. Barely conscious, Lee simply wandered off, holding both hands laced to the back of her head. Blood trickled through her fingers. She walked in front of Petunia's grill toward me, and then just stopped. I didn't have to see in order to know what was going to happen next. Christine would reverse again, back to my side, and then crush her against the wall. Desperately, I shoved the clutch in with the mop and keyed the engine again. It turned over, coughed, stalled. I could smell gasoline in the air, heavy and rich. I had flooded the engine. Christine reappeared in the rearview mirror. She came at Lee, who managed to stumble backward just out of reach. Christine slammed nose-on into the wall with crunching force. The passenger door popped open, and the horror was complete. The hand not clutching the mop handle went to my mouth, and I screamed through it. Sitting on the passenger's side, like a grotesque, life-size doll, was Michael Cunningham. His head, lolling limply on the stalk of his neck, snapped over to one side as Christine reversed to make another try at Lee, and I saw his face had the high, rosy color of carbon monoxide poisoning. He hadn't taken my advice. Christine had gone to the Cunninghams' house first, as I had vaguely suspected she might. Michael came home from school, and there she was, standing in the driveway, his son's restored 1958 Plymouth. He had gone to it, and somehow Christine had gotten him. Had he maybe gotten in just to sit behind the wheel for a moment, as I had that day in LeBay's garage? He might have, just to see what vibrations he could pick up. If so, he must have picked up some terrible vibes indeed during his last few minutes on Earth. Had Christine started herself up, driven herself into the garage? Maybe. Maybe. And had Michael discovered that he could neither turn off the madly revving engine nor get out of the car? Had he maybe turned his head and perhaps seen the true guiding spirit of Arnie's 58 Fury lounging in the shotgun seat and fainted in terror? It didn't matter now. Lee was all that mattered. She had seen too. Her screams, high, despairing and shrill, floated in the exhaust-stinking air like hysterically bright balloons. But it had, at least, cut through her daze. She turned and ran for Will Darnell's office, blood spattering behind her in dime-sized drops as she went. Blood was soaking into the collar of her parka. Too much blood. Christine backed up, laying rubber and leaving a scatter of glass behind. As she pulled around in a tight circle to go after Lee, centrifugal force pulled the passenger door shut again, but not before I saw Michael's head loll back the other way. Christine held still for a moment, her nose pointed toward Lee, her engine revving. Perhaps LeBay was savoring the instant before the kill. If so, I'm glad, because if Christine had gone for her right away, she would have been killed then. But as it was, I had an instant of time. I turned the key again, babbling something aloud, a prayer, I guess, and this time Petunia's engine coughed into life. I let the clutch out and stepped down on the accelerator as Christine leaped forward again. This time, I struck her right side. There was a shrill scream of tearing metal as Petunia's bumper punched through her mudguard. Christine heeled over and smashed against the wall. Glass broke. Her engine raced and raved. Behind the wheel, LeBay turned toward me, grinning with hate. Petunia stalled again. I rattled off a string of every curse I knew as I grabbed for the key again. If not for my goddamn leg, if not for the fall I'd taken in the snow, this would be over now. It would be just a matter of cornering her and smashing her to pieces against the cinder block. But even as I cranked Petunia's engine, keeping my foot off the gas to keep from stalling her again, Christine began to reverse with an ear-splitting squeal of metal. She backed out from between Petunia's grill and the wall, leaving a twisted chunk of her red body behind, bearing her right front tire. I got Petunia going and found reverse. Christine had backed all the way to the far end of the garage. All her headlights were out, her windshield was smashed into a galaxy of cracks, the bent hood seemed to sneer. Her radio was blasting. I could hear Ricky Nelson singing, "Waitin' in School." I stared around for Lee and saw her in Will's office, looking out into the garage. Her blonde hair was matted with blood. More blood ran down the left side of her face and soaked into her jacket. Bleeding too damn much, I thought incoherently. Bleeding too damn much, even for a head wound. Her eyes widened and she pointed past me, her lips moving soundlessly behind the glass. Christine came roaring straight up the empty floor, gaining speed. And the hood was uncrimping, straightening out and down to cover the motor cavity again. Two of the headlights flickered, then came back strong. The mudguard and the right-hand side of her body, I only caught a glimpse, but I swear it's true, they were re-knitting themselves, red metal appearing from nowhere and slipping down in smooth automotive curves to cover the right front tire and the right side of the engine compartment again. The cracks in the windshield were running inward and disappearing, and the tire that had been pulled off its rim looked as good as new. "It all looks as good as new," I thought. "God help us." She was going directly for the wall between the garage and the office. I let the mop handle off the clutch fast, hoping to interpose the tanker's body, but Christine got past me. Petunia backed into nothing but thin air. Oh, I was doing great. I backed all the way across the floor and crashed into the dented tool lockers ranged there. They crashed to the floor with dull metallic janglings. Through the windshield, I saw Christine hit the wall between the garage and Will's office. She never slowed. She went full speed ahead. I'll never forget those next few moments. They remain hypnotically clear in my memory, as if through a magnifying crystal. Lee saw Christine coming and stumbled backward. Her bloody hair was matted to her head. She fell over Will's swivel chair. She hit the floor, out of sight behind his desk. An instant later, and I mean the barest instant, Christine slammed into the wall. The big window Will had used to keep track of the comings and goings out in his garage exploded inward. Glass flew like a cluster of deadly spears. Christine's front end bulged with the impact. The hood popped up and then tore off, flying back over the roof to land on the concrete with a metallic sound that was much like the sound the falling tool lockers had made. Her windshield shattered, and Michael Cunningham's body flew through the jagged opening, legs trailing, his head a grotesque, flattened football. He was catapulted through Will's window. He struck Will's desk with a heavy grain sack thud and skidded over onto the floor. His shoes stuck up. Lee began to scream. Her fall had probably saved her from being badly lacerated or killed by the flying glass. But when she rose from behind the desk, her face was contorted with horror, and utter hysteria had its hold on her.
Michael had skidded from the desk, and his arms had looped themselves over her shoulders, and as Lee struggled to her feet, she appeared to be waltzing with the corpse. Her screams were like fire bells. Her blood, still flowing, sparkled deadly bright. She dumped Michael and ran for the door. "Lee, no!" I screamed, and slammed down the clutch with the mop again. The handle snapped cleanly in two, leaving me with a stump 5 inches long. "Oh, shit!" Christine reversed away from the broken window, leaving water, antifreeze, and oil puddled on the floor. I stamped down on the clutch with my left foot, barely feeling the pain now, bracing my left knee with my left hand as I worked the gear shift. Lee tore the office door open and ran out. Christine turned toward her, its smashed, snarling snout sighting down on her. I revved Petunia's engine and roared at her, and as that damned car from hell grew in the windshield, I saw the purple, swollen face of a child pressed to the rear window, watching me, seeming to beg me to stop. I struck her hard. The trunk lid popped up and gaped like a mouth. The rear end heeled around, and Christine went skidding sideways past Lee, who fled with her eyes seeming to swallow her face. I remember the spray of blood along the fur fringe of her parka's hood, tiny droplets like an evil fall of dew. I was in it now. I was in the peak seat. Even if they had to take my leg off at the groin when this was done, I was going to drive. Christine hit the wall and bounced back. I stamped the clutch, rammed the gear shift into reverse, backed up 10 feet, stamped the clutch again, rammed it back into first. Engine revving, Christine tried to pull away along the wall. I cut to the left and hit her again, crushing her almost wasp-waisted in the middle. The doors popped out of their frames at the top and at the bottom. LeBay was behind the wheel, now a skull, now a decayed and stinking cameo of humanity, now a hale and hearty man in his 50s with a crew cut turning white. He stared out at me with his devil's grin, one hand on the wheel, one balled into a fist that he shook at me. And still her engine would not die. I got into reverse again, and now my leg was white iron, and the pain was all the way up to my left armpit. The hell it was, the pain was everywhere. I could feel it. "Michael, Jesus, why didn't you stay in the house? In my neck, in my jaw, in my... Arnie, man, I am so sorry. I wish... Temples, the Plymouth, what remained of her, lunged drunkenly down the side of the garage, spraying tools and junk metal, pulling out struts and dumping the overhead shelves. The shelves hit the concrete with flat clapping sounds that echoed like demon applause. I stamped the clutch again and floored the gas. Petunia's engine bellowed, and I hung onto the wheel like a man trying to stay aboard a bucking Mustang. I hit her on the right side and smashed the body clear off the rear axle, driving it into the door, which shivered and rattled. I went up over the wheel, which slammed into my belly and drove the breath out of me and dumped me back into my seat, gasping. Now I saw Lee, cowering in the far corner, her hands clapped to her face, dragging it down into a witch's mask. Christine's engine was still running. She dragged herself slowly down toward Lee, like an animal whose rear legs had been broken in a trap. And even as she went, I could see her regenerating, coming back, a tire that suddenly popped up full and plump, the radio antenna that unjointed itself with a silvery twing sound, the accretion of metal around the ruined rear end. "Stay dead!" I screamed at it. I was crying, my chest heaving. My leg wouldn't work anymore. I braced it with both hands and jammed it onto the clutch. My vision went hazy and gray with the white metal agony. I could almost feel the bones grating. I raced the engine, got first gear again, and charged it. And as I did, I heard LeBay's voice for the first and only time, high and cheated and full of a terrible, unquenchable fury. "You shitter! Fuck off, you miserable shitter! Leave me alone!" "You should have left my friend alone," I tried to yell, but all that would come out was a tearing, wounded gasp. I hit it squarely in the rear end, and the gas tank ruptured as the back of the car accordioned inward and upward in a kind of metal mushroom. There was a yellow lick of fire. I shielded my face with my hands, but then it was gone. Christine sat there, a refugee from a demolition derby. Her engine ran choppily, missed, fired again, and then died. The place was silent, except for the bass rumble of Petunia's engine. Then Lee was running across the floor, screaming my name over and over, crying. I was suddenly stupidly aware that I was wearing her pink nylon scarf around the arm of my jacket. I looked down at it, and then the world grayed out again. I could feel her hands on me, and then there was nothing but darkness as I fainted. I came to about 15 minutes later, my face wet and blessedly cool. Lee was standing on Petunia's driver's side running board, mopping my face with a wet rag. I caught it in one hand, tried to suck it, and then spat. The rag tasted strongly of oil.
"Dennis, don't worry," she said. "I ran out into the street, stopped a snowplow, scared the poor man out of 10 years of his life, I think, on this blood. He said, an ambulance, he said he'd, you know, Dennis, are you all right?"
"Do I look all right?" I whispered.
"No,"
she said, and burst into tears. "Then don't," I swallowed past a painful, dry lump in my throat. "Don't ask stupid questions. I love you." She hugged me clumsily.
"He said he'd call the police, too," she said.
I barely heard her. My eyes had found the twisted, silent hulk that was Christine's remains. And hulk was the right word. She hardly looked like a car at all anymore. But why hadn't she burned? A hubcap lay off to one side like a dented silver tiddlywink. "How long since you stopped the plow?" I asked hoarsely.
"Maybe 5 minutes. Then I got the rag and dipped it in that bucket over there. Dennis, thank God it's over."
Punk, punk, punk. I was still looking at the hubcap. The dents were popping out of it. Abruptly, it flicked up on its rim and rolled toward the car like a huge coin. Lee saw it, too. Her face froze. Her eyes widened and began to bulge. Her lips mouthed the word no, but no sound came out. "Get in here with me," I said in a low voice, as if it could hear us. How do I know? Perhaps it could. "Get in on the passenger side. You're going to run the gas while I run the clutch with my right foot."
"No!"
This time it was a hissing whisper. Her breath came in whining little gasps.
"No! No!"
The wreckage was quivering all over. It was the most eerie, most terrible thing I have ever seen in my life. It was quivering all over, quivering like an animal that is not quite dead. Metal tapped nervously against metal. Tie rods clicked jittery jazz rhythms against their connectors. As I watched, a bent cotter pin lying on the floor straightened itself and did half a dozen cartwheels to land in the wreckage. "Get in," I said.
"Dennis, I can't."
Her lips quivered helplessly.
"I can't. No more. That body. That was Arnie's father. I can't no more, please."
"You have to," I said. She looked at me, glanced affrightedly back at the obscenely quivering remains of that old whore LeBay and Arnie had shared, and then came around Petunia's front end. A piece of chrome tumbled and scratched her leg deeply. She screamed and ran. She clambered up into the cab and pushed over beside me.
What do I do?
I hung halfway out of the cab, holding onto the roof, and pushed the clutch down with my right foot. Petunia's engine was still running. "Just gun the gas and keep it gunned," I said, "no matter what." Steering with my right hand, holding on with my left, I let the clutch out, and we rolled forward and smashed into the wreckage, smashing it, scattering it, and in my head I seemed to hear another scream of fury. Lee clapped her hands to her head.
"I can't, Dennis. I can't do it. It's screaming."
"You've got to do it," I said. Her foot had come off the gas, and now I could hear sirens in the night, rising and falling. I grabbed her shoulder, and a sickening blast of pain ripped up my leg. "Lee, nothing has changed. You've got to."
"It screamed at me."
"We're running out of time, and it still isn't done. Just a little more."
"I'll try,"
she whispered, and stepped on the gas again. I shifted into reverse. Petunia rolled back 20 feet. I clutched again, got first.
and Lee suddenly cried out, "Dennis, no, don't, look!"
The mother and the little girl, Veronica and Rita, were standing in front of the smashed and dented hulk of Christine, hand in hand, their faces solemn and sorrowing.
"They're not there," I said, "and if they are, it's time they went back."
More pain in my leg, and the world went gray.
"Back to where they belong. Keep your foot on it."
I let out the clutch, and Petunia rolled forward again, gaining speed. The two figures did not disappear as TV and movie ghosts do. They seemed to stream out in every direction, bright colors fading to wash pinks and blues. And then they were totally gone. We slammed into Christine again, spinning what was left of her around. Metal shrieked and tore.
"Not there," Lee whispered. "Not really there. Okay. Okay, Dennis."
Her voice was coming from far down a dark hallway. I fetched up reverse, and back we went. Then forward. We hit it. We hit it again. How many times? I don't know. We just kept slamming into it, and every time we did, another jolt of pain would go up my leg, and things would get a little bit darker. At last I looked up, blearily, and saw that the air outside the door seemed full of blood. But it wasn't blood. It was a pulsing red light reflecting off the falling snow. People were rattling at the door out there.
"Is it good enough?"
Lee asked me. I looked at Christine, only it wasn't Christine anymore. It was a spread-out pile of twisted, gored metal, puffs of upholstery, and glittering, broken glass.
"Have to be," I said.
"Let them in, Lee." And while she went, I fainted again. Then there were a series of confused images, things that came into focus for a while and then faded or disappeared completely. I can remember a stretcher being rolled out of the back of an ambulance. I can remember its sides being folded up and how the overhead fluorescence put cold highlights on its chrome. I can remember someone saying, "Cut it, you have to cut it off so we can at least look at it." I can remember someone else, Lee, I think, saying, "Don't hurt him, please, don't hurt him if you can help it." I can remember the roof of an ambulance. It had to be an ambulance because at the periphery of my vision were two suspended IV bottles. I can remember a cool swab of antiseptic and then the sting of a needle. After that, things became exceedingly weird. I knew somewhere deep inside that I was not dreaming. The pain proved that, if it proved nothing else. But all of it seemed like a dream. I was pretty well doped, and that was part of it. But shock was part of it, too. No fake, Jake. My mother was there, crying, in a room that looked sickeningly like the hospital room in which I had spent the entire autumn. Then my father was there, and Lee's dad was with him, and their faces were both so tight and grim, they looked like Tweedledum and Tweedledee, as Franz Kafka might have written them. My father bent over me and said in a voice like thunder, reverberating through cotton batting,
"How did Michael get there, Dennis?"
That's what they really wanted to know, how Michael got there.
Oh, I thought. Oh, my friends, I could tell you stories.
Then Mr. Cabot was saying, "What did you get my daughter into, boy?" I seemed to remember replying,
"It's not what I got her into. It's what she got you out of."
Which I still think was pretty witty under the circumstances, doped up the way I was and all. Elaine was there briefly, and she seemed to be holding a yodel or a Twinkie or something mockingly out of my reach. Lee was there, holding her filmy nylon scarf out and asking me to raise my arm so she could tie it on. But I couldn't. My arm was like a lead bar. Then Arnie was there. And of course that had to be a dream.
"Thanks, man," he said,
and I noticed with something like terror that the left lens of his glasses was shattered. His face was okay, but that broken lens, it scared me.
"Thanks. You did okay. I feel better now. I think things are gonna be okay now."
"No sweat, Arnie," I said, or tried to say. But he was gone. It was the next day,
not the 20th, but Sunday, January 21st, that I started to come back a little. My left leg was in a cast, up in its old familiar position again, amid all the pulleys and weights. There was a man I had never seen before, sitting to the left of my bed, reading a paperback John D. MacDonald story. He saw me looking at him, and lowered his book. "Welcome back to the land of the living, Dennis," he said mildly, and deliberately marked his place in the book with a matchbook cover. He put the book in his lap and folded his hands over it.
"Are you a doctor?" I asked.
He sure wasn't Dr. Arroway, who had taken care of me last time. This guy was 20 years younger and at least 50 pounds leaner. He looked tough.
"State Police Inspector," he said. "Richard Mercer is my name. Rick, if you like."
He held out his hand, and stretching awkwardly and carefully, I touched it. I couldn't really shake it. My head ached, and I was thirsty.
"Look," I said, "I don't really mind talking to you, and I'll answer all of your questions, but I'd like to see a doctor."
I swallowed. He looked at me, concerned, and I blurted out, "I need to know if I'm ever going to walk again."
"If what that fellow Arroway says is the truth," Mercer said, "you'll be able to get around in 4 to 6 weeks. You didn't break it again, Dennis. You severely strained it. That was what he said. It swelled up like a sausage. He also said you were lucky to get off so cheap."
"What about Arnie?" I asked. "Arnie Cunningham? Do you know..." His eyes flickered. "What is it?" I asked. "What is it about Arnie?"
"Dennis," he said, and then hesitated. "I don't know if this is the time."
"Please, is Arnie... is he dead?" Mercer sighed.
"Yes. He's dead. He and his mother had an accident on the Pennsylvania Turnpike in the snow. If it was an accident."
I tried to talk and couldn't. I motioned for the pitcher of water on the bed table, thinking how dismal it was to be in a hospital room and know exactly where everything was. Mercer poured me a glass and put the straw with the elbow bend in it. I drank, and it got a little bit better. My throat, that is. Nothing else seemed better at all.
"What do you mean, if it was an accident?"
Mercer said, "It was Friday evening, and the snow just wasn't that heavy. The turnpike classification was 2, barren wet, reduced visibility, use appropriate caution. We guess, from the force of impact, that they weren't doing much more than 45. The car veered across the median and struck a semi. It was Mrs. Cunningham's Volvo wagon. It exploded."
I closed my eyes. "Regina?"
"Also DOA. For whatever it's worth, they probably didn't..."
"Suffer," I finished.
"Bullshit.
They suffered plenty."
I felt tears and choked them back. Mercer said nothing.
"All 3 of them," I muttered. "Oh, Jesus Christ. All 3.
The driver of the truck broke his arm. That was the worst of it for him. He said that there were 3 people in the car, Dennis."
3?
"Yes. And he said they appeared to be struggling."
Mercer looked at me frankly.
"We're going on the theory that they picked up a bad news hitchhiker who escaped after the accident and before the troopers arrived."
But that was ridiculous. If you knew Regina Cunningham, I thought, she would no more pick up a hitchhiker than she would wear slacks to a faculty tea. The things you did and those you never did were firmly set in Regina Cunningham's mind, as if in cement, you could say. It had been LeBay. He couldn't be both places at once. That was the thing. And at the end, when he saw how things were going in Darnell's garage, he had abandoned Christine and had tried to go back to Arnie. What had happened then was anyone's guess. But I thought then, and I do now, that Arnie fought him and earned at least a draw.
"Dead," I said, and now the tears did come. I was too weak and low to stop them. I hadn't been able to keep him from getting killed, after all.
Not the last time. Not when it really mattered. Others, maybe. But not Arnie.
"Tell me what happened," Mercer said. He put his book on the bed table and leaned forward. "Tell me everything you know, Dennis, from first to last."
"What has Lee said?" I asked. "And how is she?"
"She spent Friday night here under observation," Mercer told me. "She had a concussion and a scalp laceration that took a dozen stitches to close. No marks on her face. Lucky. She's a very pretty girl."
"She's more than that," I said. "She's beautiful."
"She won't say anything," Mercer said,
and a reluctant grin of admiration, I think, slanted his face to the left.
"Not to me, not to her father. He is, shall we say, in a state of hot piss-off about the whole thing. She says it's your business what to tell and when to tell."
He looked at me thoughtfully.
"Because," she says, "you're the one who ended it."
"I didn't do such a great job," I muttered. I was still trying to cope with the idea that Arnie could possibly be dead. It was impossible, wasn't it? We had gone to Camp Winesco in Vermont together when we were 12, and I got homesick and told him I was going to call and tell my parents they had to come get me. Arnie said if I did, he'd tell everybody at school that the reason I came home early was that they caught me eating boogers in my bunk after lights out and expelled me. We climbed the tree in my backyard to the very top fork and carved our initials there. He used to sleep over at my house, and we'd stay up late watching shock theater, crouched together on the sofa under an old quilt. We ate all those clandestine Wonder Bread sandwiches. When he was 14, Arnie came to me, scared and ashamed, because he was having these sexy dreams, and he thought they were making him wet the bed. But it was the ant farms my mind kept coming back to. How could he be dead when we had made those ant farms together? Dear Christ, it seemed like only a week or two ago, those ant farms. So how could he be dead? I opened my mouth to tell Mercer that Arnie couldn't be dead. Those ant farms made the very idea absurd. Then I closed my mouth again. I couldn't tell him that. He was just a guy. "Arnie," I thought. "Hey, man. It's not true, is it? Jesus Christ, we still got too much to do. We never even double-tated at the drive-in yet."
"What happened?" Mercer asked again. "Tell me, Dennis."
"You'd never believe it," I said thickly.
"You might be surprised what I'd believe," he said. "And you might be surprised what we know. A fellow named Junkins was the chief investigator on this case. He was killed not so very far from here. He was a good friend of mine. A good friend. A week before he died, he told me that he thought something was going on in Libertyville that nobody would believe. Then he was killed. With me? That makes it personal."
I shifted positions cautiously. "He didn't tell you any more?"
"He told me that he believed he had uncovered an old murder," Mercer said, still not taking his eyes from mine. "But it didn't much matter," he said, "because the perpetrator was dead."
"LeBay," I muttered, and thought that if Junkins had known about that, it was no wonder Christine had killed him. Because if Junkins had known that, he had been much too close to the whole truth.
Mercer said, "LeBay was the name he mentioned." He leaned closer. "And I'll tell you something else, Dennis. Junkins was one hell of a driver. When he was younger, before he got married, he used to run stockers at Philly Plains, and he won his share of checkered flags. He went off the road doing better than 120 in a Dodge Cruiser with a Hemi engine. Whoever was chasing him, and we know someone was, had to be one hell of a driver."
"Yeah," I said. "He was."
"I came by myself. I've been here for 2 hours waiting for you to wake up. I was here until they kicked me out last night. I don't have a stenographer with me, I don't have a tape recorder, and I assure you that I'm not wearing a wire. When you make a statement, if you ever have to, that'll be a different ballgame. But for now, it's you and me. I have to know.
Because I see Rudy Junkins' wife and Rudy Junkinson's kids from time to time. You dig?
I thought it over. For a long time, I thought it over. Nearly 5 minutes. He sat there and let me do it. At last, I nodded.
Okay. But you're still not gonna believe it. We'll see,
he said. I opened my mouth with no idea of what was gonna come out. He was a loser, you know, I said. Every high school has to have at least two. It's like a national law. Everyone's dumping ground, only sometimes... sometimes they find something to hold on to, and they survive. Arnie had me. And then... he had Christine. I looked at him, and if I had seen the slightest wrong flicker in those gray eyes that were so unsettlingly like Arnie's, well, if I had seen that, I think I would have clammed up right there and told him to put it on his books in whatever way seemed the most plausible and to tell Rudy Junkins' kids whatever the hell he pleased. But he only nodded, watching me closely. I just wanted you to understand that, I said. And then a lump rose in my throat, and I couldn't say what I maybe should have said next. Lee Cabot came later. I drank some more water and swallowed hard. I talked for the next 2 hours. At last, I finished. There was no big climax. I simply dried up, my throat sore from so much talking. I didn't ask if he believed me. I didn't ask if he was going to have me locked up in a loony bin or give me a liar's medal. I knew that he believed a great deal of it, because what I knew dovetailed too well with what he knew. What he thought about the rest of it, Christine and LeBay and the past reaching out its hands toward the present, that I didn't know. And don't to this day. Not really. A little silence fell between us. At last he slapped his hands down on his thighs with a brisk sound and got to his feet.
Well, he said, your folks will be waiting to visit you, no doubt.
Probably, yeah. He took out his wallet and produced a small white business card with his name and number on it.
I can usually be reached here, or someone will throw me a relay. When you speak to Lee Cabot again, would you tell her what you've told me and ask her to get in touch?
Yes, if you want, I'll do that.
Will she corroborate your story?
Yes.
He looked at me fixedly. I'll tell you this much, Dennis, he said. If you're lying, you don't know you are.
He left. I only saw him once more, and that was at the triple funeral for Arnie and his parents. The papers reported a tragic and bizarre fairy tale. Father killed in driveway car accident while mother and son are killed on Pennsylvania Turnpike. Paul Harvey used it on his program. No mention was made of Christine's being at Darnell's garage. My family came to visit that night, and by then I was feeling much easier in my mind. Part of it was bearing my bosom to Mercer, I think. He was what one of my psych profs in college called an interested outsider. The sort it's often easiest to talk to. But a great lot of the way I felt was due to a flying late-afternoon visit by Dr. Arroway. He was out of temper and irascible with me, suggesting that next time I just take a chainsaw to the goddamn leg and save us all a lot of time and trouble. But he also informed me, grudgingly, I think, that no lasting damage had been done. He thought. He warned me that I had not improved my chances of ever running in the Boston Marathon. And left. So the family visit was a gay one, due mostly to Ellie, who prattled on and on about that upcoming cataclysm, her first date. A pimply, bullet-headed nerd named Brandon Herling had invited her to go roller skating with him. My dad was going to drive them. Pretty cool. My mother and father joined in, but my mother kept throwing anxious, "Don't forget" glances at Dad, and he lingered after Mom had taken Elaine out.
"What happened?"
he asked me.
Lee told her father some crazy story about cars driving themselves and little girls who were dead and I don't know what all. He's damn near wild. I nodded. I was tired, but I didn't want Lee catching hell from her folks, or have them thinking she was either lying or nuts. If she was going to cover me with Mercer, I would have to cover her with her mother and father. All right, I said. It's a bit of a story. You want to send Mom and Ellie around for a malt or something? Or maybe you better tell them to go to a movie. That long? Yeah, that long. He looked at me, his gaze troubled. Okay, he said. Shortly after, I told my story a second time. Now, I've told it a third. And third time, so they say, pays for all. Rest in peace, Arnie. I love you, man.